Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode 324. This week in the news, I just wanted to say thanks to everybody out there subscribing to the Masonic Curators on YouTube. It's a new series we're doing where we're showcasing cool Masonic artifacts and trinkets and things that we are proud to own and have a story. So it's preservation through storytelling. And if you look for it on YouTube, you can do that, or you can subscribe right from our MasonicCurators.com, or you can go to curators.wcypodcast.com. Either way, it'll take you there. We have a simple blog page that just has a video for each post, and the latest three from this last week were, of course, the Jefferson Bible. I did one on a copy of a really rad book I was given. It's a book on Eleusis. And on Friday, we did the Masonic Curators Episode 9, which was about the working tools. Interesting side note is that in the video I mentioned the working tools are from 1960 or manufactured there or abouts. Actually, they're from 1920. My wife is the person who acquired them and showed me the dates on the certificate of authenticity. So, yeah, 1920, massive failure on my part. Unfortunately, YouTube doesn't allow annotations anymore. Otherwise, I'd go in there and make that a point. However, it's up there, and take it for what it's worth. It's really cool stuff. We've done 9 videos so far, and coming up next week, that's this upcoming Tuesday, if you're listening to this on release night, it'll be December 12th. 2017, we will release the next Masonic Curators, which is such a great episode. It's featuring illustrious Brother Stephen L. Harrison, who makes our Masonic Minute segments all the time, every other week or so, and he brings that same amazing style to Masonic Curators. I've got another one after that that'll have Brother Greg Knott featured. So you guys out there who have something cool, please consider putting together a little something for Masonic Curators. I know you all have some great stuff. Go ahead and click on submissions on the website and you'll see. And it's not some crazy guidelines. I mean, really, it's just ideally we're hoping you shoot it with your phone, you send it over and you shoot it in at least your phone's capability. So that's usually 420. And if you have an iPhone, then you're shooting in either 720p, 1080, or even 4K sometimes. So anyhow, you want to do that, you can put it up on your own YouTube channel, and we want you to go ahead and just keep it a private video and then shoot the link over to us. And then I can download it from YouTube or download it from Dropbox or however you guys want to get it to me in a link. Usually the video files are at least 500 megabytes, maybe a little less, but that's just too big for email. So we need to send it through links. I can download from pretty much anywhere, and I'll format it and put up the bumpers in the beginning and at the end. And then we get you up on the YouTube channel explaining something pretty cool. Feel free to script it or whatever you feel you have to do to tell the cool story. But largely, this is not just a project of my collection of trinkets and things, but really I want to get a feel and tell the story and preserve the stories of your items just as much as the things that I have. So please consider doing that. Again, wcypodcast.com or curators.wcypodcast.com. In other news, the Scottish Rite Northern Masonic Jurisdiction had a webinar or a web inquiry session with the brand new Sovereign Grand Commander, David Glatley. As many of you know, I've been, I will say, hypercritical of the Northern Masonic Jurisdiction's direction over the past, well, ever since 2012 when I joined the Scottish Rite. And my criticism has been, you know, fairly open, and it is due to the lack of Masonic education. And to some extent, a disappointment in the ritual in terms of what was considered necessary. And I watched this webinar, and I was really interested to see what illustrious Brother Glatley had to say. And, you know, he totally nailed it on everything. He had some great comments on ritual. He had some wonderful commentary on the importance of education. And what the Northern Jurisdiction is doing right now, they are putting together really great materials for Blue Lodges and Grand Lodges to be able to push out there to get our message out to the masses. So I just want to say thanks to the Northern Jurisdiction for doing what the membership asked them to do. It's a really cool thing. So our brothers in the Northern Jurisdiction aren't just going to get the new HGA, the Academy. It sounds like we're getting a whole new direction, and a dedication. He made me laugh a few times when he finger wagged at the camera and said something along the lines of, "You won't find any ritual police here." And it was a really kind of a funny moment. But if you have a minute, definitely head on over to ScottishRiteNMJ.org and find the links for that video. Now, if you can't find it on the website, just check out their Facebook page. It's all over there, and I'm sure lots of people are sharing it. I think I shared it as well on our WCY Facebook page. So while you're there, check it out. This is Ritual Month on the Masonic Roundtable, so each week we're kind of hitting on a specific Masonic author who is responsible for some of our ritual. Last Tuesday, we touched on William Preston, and if you missed that episode, you're going to want to go back and give it a good listen, because you find out some things, some really interesting things about our cavalier friend William Preston, who was in his day larger than life, so much so that he was larger than the Grand Lodge. So go back and check that out. There's some really interesting commentary there. And next week, or just a couple days from this, if you're listening to this on release night, we're going to be talking about Webb. So don't miss that one. That's going to be another one. I'm not sure if he's going to be as controversial as William Preston was, but we'll see. This week we've got a few Masonic pieces for you, some short, some longer, the longest of which is actually going to be a really cool piece that was featured in the Occult Review back in 1924, a piece which was contributed by W.L. Wilmhurst. Does that name sound familiar? I hope it does. He's a pretty big name in Freemasonry, and so we'll check that out, as well as a few other pieces this week, so stay tuned. All right, the first piece I have for you this week was something I wrote quite a long time ago, and I may have even read it on the show before, but it's so short, so I figured I would just go ahead and read it, especially because it is related to this season, and it's The Mistletoe, Mythology, Meaning, and a Representation of the Craft. Again, I published this on the Midnight Freemasons a few years ago, probably 3 or 4. December, the time of year where the masses get ready to embrace a new year and rebirth. Holidays are plenty, Hanukkah, Christmas, the solstice, Kwanzaa, and during these times there are seasonal plants which bear special meanings. Two such plants ring aloud like a beautiful song, and when you put those notes on paper, your eyes would behold an evergreen and the mistletoe commonly brought into homes this time of year. The meaning of the Christmas tree goes back to Scandinavia, when the people would bring the still green tree into their homes as everything else died in the winter months. This was done as a good luck symbol, a symbol of the life that conquers death. We in Freemasonry call it the acacia. But as you have no doubt read, this article is entitled Mistletoe. The mistletoe has also an astounding significance to Freemasonry. The mistletoe was a sacred plant among the Druids and symbolized immortality, again a direct correlation to our acacia. In Scandinavia, they called it simply mistel, or missile. In Scandinavian mythology, the second son of Odin was named Balder. Balder had a dream that he would die. Upon waking, he held counsel with the gods. His mother Freyja then cast a spell, which gave him immunity from all harmful things, poisons, darts, water, earth, fire, birds, plants, reptiles, and beasts. After some time, the gods began to test Balder's immunity by sending danger his way. The displeased Loki, god of mischief, was not amused, so he disguised himself as an old woman and secured from Balder's mother the one thing omitted from the spell that protected her son, the shrub mistletoe. Loki fashioned a dart of mistletoe and gave it to the blind god of war, who was still having fun testing his non-vulnerabilities. He helped him take aim and pierced Balder's heart, killing him. Sorrow among the gods was immeasurable. The tears of Balder's mother Freyja are said to have formed the white berries on the mistletoe plant, and from then on, Balder is said to wait in Hades until the end of the world. The power of the mistletoe to symbolically pierce one's heart by commanding a kiss from any who walk under it is what we perceive today. However, mistletoe has one last interesting point that I wish to convey before the end of the short piece. It is a shrub that many cultures have deemed sacred because the leaves and berries always grow in three and come from one common stalk. Like Freemasonry, we too have three, which delineate from one stalk, or in our case, the men who were first prepared to be Masons in that place in which the mistletoe can pierce the heart. All right, I hope you enjoyed that quick short piece for the holidays. Next, I've got another short piece that, again, wrote quite a few years ago for the Midnight Freemasons as well, and it's called So You Think You Know Freemasonry. So you watched those special documentaries about Freemasons. They revealed handshakes, oaths, and other secret words. Some of our brothers have grown sick and nauseous knowing that something as sacred as our ritual is being exposed in this way. I too was upset. However, I was only upset because it is the latest incarnation of media to the masses related to Freemasonry. Before this, there were several tell-all books, and you can find all the quote-unquote grand Masonic words on the internet by simply searching for 5 minutes or less. If you will recall Brother Albert Pike, who exposed much of Masonry to the world in his Morals and Dogma, a book that still today causes Masons grief as the language and what he speaks about is taken out of context by nearly all who read it, mostly because they are not from the fraternity and know not of how to interpret these things. These new shows try and make a visual for all who want to know more about us. And of course, when someone knows something of your sacred vows and has not taken them themselves, it feels cheapened in a way. But this feeling is temporary. And I say this because I ask you now, have any of these shows ever gotten it 100% right? And if they have, I'll tell you one thing that they have not done. They have never revealed any of our actual teachings. The real treasure, the knowledge. Think about it. Have you ever seen a brother giving a lecture on one of these Freemasonry revealed shows? No, you haven't. All they reveal, if anything, are some of our traditions. So if you're one of those fellows out there who thinks that you know Freemasonry because you've watched all the shows, you really don't know anything yet. We are a society with secrets, and I don't care what anyone says on television or in books, there are secrets, and I'm not talking about just passwords and handshakes. Those secrets are the roadmap to other things that we are said to have. A treasure, and that treasure is attainable as well. Those secrets are in the lectures, and the treasure is knowledge. You may think that you understand this, but until you've passed through our solemn ceremonies and take your obligations, anything you have seen pales in comparison to what actually feels like to become a Freemason. So, if these shows have sparked an interest, find a local lodge and find out more. If these shows scare you, I would urge you to do the same. I'll leave you with this. When Freemasonry is being showcased in a special on television and you learn something about it, I would say you learn no more about it than what you would learn about the cosmos in an hour or two special. Do you really think that all you need to know can be compressed into 2 hours? Would you go into outer space and solve physics-based problems because you watched Morgan Freeman explain wormholes? I don't think you would. The same is true for Freemasonry. You cannot but hope to attain all we have to offer. But it takes a lifetime, not a 44-minute special with commercial breaks. Alright, and finally for this week, I have the meat of the episode. This is, of course, from the Occult Review, March 1924, Notes of the Month. And this is concerning cosmic consciousness. And this was contributed by W.L. Wilmhurst. I will tell you that the paper in its full form will be within the show application extras. So if you hear me talk about the app extras in the show notes every week, or sometimes I mention it on the show, if you don't have our app, go get it. Download the podcast source for your mobile device, Windows 10, on Google Play. And then once you download that, do a search for Whence Came You once inside the app. You're going to see our show. You're going to add it to your favorites. It's totally free. And every single week, we throw a Masonic wallpaper up there, as well as the papers that we read on the show. Sometimes some other things as well, like short videos. But this week, we will have the Concerning Cosmic Consciousness by W.L. Wilmhurst in its full form right there for you to download. Masonic education in the palm of your hand, so check it out. Again, totally free. Concerning Cosmic Consciousness, contributed by W.L. Wilmhurst. It is rather to be assumed that a man who writes about cosmic consciousness has undergone the experience in his own person. Otherwise, what should lead to his writing on so strange and so abnormal an experience? We are not, however, entitled to assume that the individual who has had the experience in question is necessarily capable of writing a good book or even writing convincingly on the subject. Perhaps in a certain sense, the outsider who has had no such experience can write more dispassionately and therefore with less bias on the nature of this strange phenomenon. The first edition of Dr. Buck's Cosmic Consciousness, A Study in the Evolution of the Human Mind by Richard Maurice Buck, M.D., American Book Supply Company, Limited, 149 Strand, London, was published as long ago as 1901. The book has been out of print some time, and the present edition has been corrected and entirely reset throughout. It has, I believe, the outstanding merit of being whatever it defects the only comprehensive book on the subject in existence, Dr. Buck describes in his own sensations when, at the beginning of his 36th year, he met with this experience, as this incident is the foundation stonework in question and led to an entire change in the author's whole mental and spiritual attitude. It is well to give an account of it in his own words. It will be noted that, though the account is his own, he writes on himself in the third person. It was in the early spring, at the beginning of his 36th year. He and two friends had spent the evening reading Wadsworth, Shelley, Keats, Browning, and especially Whitman. They parted at midnight, and he had a long drive and hansom. It was in an English city. His mind deeply under the influence of the ideas, images, and emotions called up by the reading and talk of the evening. It was calm and peaceful. He was in a state of quiet, almost passive enjoyment. All at once, without warning of any kind, he found himself wrapped around, as it were, by a flame-colored cloud. For an instant, he thought of fire, some sudden conflagration in the great city. The next, he knew that the light was within himself. Directly afterwards came upon him a sense of exaltation, of immense joyousness, accompanied or immediately followed by an intellectual illumination quite impossible to describe. Into his brain streamed one momentary lightning flash of the Brahmic splendor which has ever since lighted his life. Upon his heart fell one drop of Brahmic bliss, leaving the thenceforward for always an aftertaste of heaven. Among other things he did not come to believe, he saw and knew that the cosmos is not dead matter, but a living presence, that the soul of man is immortal, and the universe is so built and ordered that without any peradventure all things work together for the good of each other and all, that the foundation principle of four, the world is what we call love, and that the happiness of everyone is in the long run absolutely certain. He claims that he learned more within a few seconds during which the illumination lasted than in a previous months or even years of study, and that he learned much that no study could have ever taught. This experience that has altered, in this and other similar cases, the whole tenor of the percipient's outlook on life appears in its purer form to have certain main characteristics. The person affected realizes as never before the oneness of the universe. He sees himself as part and parcel of this unity which he senses as the expression of a single conscious life. At the moment of the experience, the realization of the conscious and the separatedness of the ego and the non-ego, the knower and the known, entirely disappears. The man who has once had it is no longer able to feel a shadow of doubt as to human immortality. He knows it is with certain that no argument or evidence can strengthen or shake. Jesus presumably had this experience on the Mount of Transfiguration, and the Buddha writes over and over again as if he were familiar with it, as for instance when he tells us how he attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. Among earlier mystics who have had kindred experiences, the case of St. Paul is probably the most familiar to readers, though we should hardly be justified in affirming in either of the two experiences recorded of him that they were certainly instances of what might strictly be termed cosmic consciousness, though perhaps the latter, one to which he alludes in a very cryptic manner, may have been more definitely of this nature. The first of these, it will be remembered, was on the road to Damascus when he was converted to Christianity and had a vision of the Christ and saw the great light which had the effect of blinding him for some days afterward. The other was many years later when he was caught up in the third heaven and heard, as he says, quote unquote, unspeakable words which it is not lawful for man to utter. The seeing of this great light is one of the phenomena which reoccur again and again in these records and seems to show that St. Paul's first experience was at least akin to the other phenomena of the kind. We should perhaps associate with these experiences what has been termed beatific vision, which comes to the religious devotee rather than to the mystical philosopher, and should, I would submit, be regarded as a more personal phase of the same experience. It may be that the beatific vision is in the nature of a realization of the higher self, or the Christ in man, while cosmic consciousness is in the nature of an intuitive perception of the immanence of the deity in all manifested life, and the essential oneness of the universal consciousness. According as the mind of the percipient is attuned by his past life and spiritual outlook, so does he attain to either one form of the experience or the other. Certainly, the most noteworthy records in early days, outside those which may be set down as a specifically religious character, are those recorded of the great mystical philosopher Plotinus, of whose experiences in the matter there is no suspicion of doubt. Plotinus was born in AD 204 and died approximately at the age of 70. His philosophic training and ascetic life rendered him a peculiar, favorable subject for such an experience. His ideas as the true inwardness of the cosmic scheme are beautifully expressed in the following passage. There is a raying out of all orders of existence, an external emanation from the ineffable One. There is again returning impulse, drawing all upwards and inwards toward the center from whence we all came. Love, as Plato in the Banquet beautifully states, is child of poverty and plenty. In the amorous quest of the soul after the good lies the painful sense of fall and deprivation. But that love is a blessing, is salvation, is our guardian genius. Without it, the centrifugal law would overpower us and sweep our souls out far from this source, toward the cold extremities of the material and the manifold. The wise man recognizes the idea of the good within him. This he develops by withdrawal into the place of his soul. He who does not understand how the soul contains the beautiful within itself seeks to realize beauty without, by laborious production. His aim should rather be to concentrate and simplify, and so to expand his being instead of going out into the manifold to forsake it for the One, and so to float upwards toward the divine fount of being whose stream flows within him. He asks, how can we know the infinite? And replies that it cannot be known by reason, but only by a faculty superior to his, to this, which is attained by entering into a state in which man has his finite sense no longer, and in which the divine essence is communicated to him. This, he says, is quote-unquote ecstasy. And clearly, by this expression, ecstasy, which really means standing outside of oneself, Plotinus is referring to the phenomenon of cosmic consciousness. For he adds, when you thus cease to be finite, you become one with the infinite. He also observes that this sublime condition is not of permanent duration, and it is only now and then that it can be enjoyed. I myself, he says, have realized it but 3 times as yet. He tells us that, quote-unquote, all that tends to purify and elevate the mind will assist us in this attainment and will facilitate the approach and recurrence of these happy intervals. Plotinus offers a philosophical justification for such experiences. External objects, he tells us, present us only with appearances. The problem of true knowledge, on the other hand, deals with the ideal reality that exists behind these appearances. It follows, therefore, that the religion of the truth is not to be investigated as a thing external to us, and so only imperfectly known. Rather, it is within us. Truth, therefore, he maintains, is not the agreement of our apprehension of an external object with the object itself, but it is the agreement of the mind with itself. Hence, he contends, knowledge has 3 degrees, opinions, science, and illumination. The instrument of the first is sense, of the second, dialect, and the third, intuition. The third is the absolute knowledge founded on the identity of the mind knowing with the object known. We have little evidence bearing on this phenomenon between the post-classical times of Plotinus and the later Middle Ages. In these times, however, there are many noteworthy experiences recorded with greater or less historical truth of the Catholic saints of the period, conspicuous among whom may be named John Yepes, more commonly known as St. John of the Cross, and St. Teresa, both of whose lives date as recently as the 16th century AD. St. John of the Cross was born in 1542 and died in 1591. At the age of 21, he adopted the religious habit of the Carmelite friars. In 1578, he was imprisoned for some months for certain practices of kind which were regarded by the ecclesiastical authorities as unorthodox, and it was during this period, at the age of 36, that he had the mysterious psychic experience which is identified by Dr. Buck with the phenomenon known of cosmic consciousness. Though it must be admitted that the evidence with regard to its specific character is not altogether conclusive. His biographer, David Lewis, gives the account of as follows. His cell became filled with light, seen by the bodily eye. One night the friar who kept him went as usual to see that his prisoner was safe, and witnessed the heavenly light with which the cell was flooded. He did not stop to consider it, but hurried to the prior, thinking that someone in the house had keys to open the doors of the prison. The prior, with 2 members of the order, went at once to the prison, but on his entering the room through which the prison was approached, the light had vanished. The prior, however, entered the cell, and finding it dark, opened the lantern with which he had provided himself, and asked the prisoner who had given him the light. St. John answered him, and said that no one in the house had done so, that no one could do it, and that there was neither candle nor lamp in the cell. The prior made no reply and went away, thinking that the reporter had made a mistake. St. John, at a later time, told one of his brethren that the heavenly light which God so mercifully sent him lasted the night through, and that it filled his soul with joy and made the night pass away as if it were but a moment. When his imprisonment was drawing to its close, he heard our Lord say to him, as it were out of the soft light that was around him, quote, John, I am here, be not afraid, I will set thee free, end quote. A few months later, while making his escape from the prison of the monastery, it is said that he had a repetition of the experience as follows. He saw a wonderful light, out of which came a voice, follow me. He followed, and the light moved before him towards the wall, which was on the bank, and then he knew not how he found himself on the summit of it without effort or fatigue. He descended into the street, and then the light vanished. So brilliant was it that for 2 or 3 days afterward, so he confessed at a later time, his eyes were weak, as if it had been looking at the sun in its strength. End quote. Elsewhere, St. John of the Cross refers to his own spiritual experiences in language, which suggests that these were of a similar character to those already recorded, but his language is vague, and deliberately so, as he says that his description of his experience, quote, relates to the matters so interior and spiritual as to battle the powers of language. All I say, he continues, falls far short of that which passes in this intimate union of powers of the soul with God. I stood enraptured in ecstasy beside myself, and in every sense no sense remained. My spirit was endowed with understanding, understanding not, all knowledge transcending. He who really ascends so high annihilates himself, and all his previous knowledge seems ever less and less. End quote. St. Teresa's mystical experiences is well known were legion. They included the stigmata, which is the imprint of the 5 wounds of the crucifixion, levitation, clairvoyance, clairaudience, etc. She, too, had an experience which she terms the orison of union, which corresponds closely by its description to cosmic consciousness. In this orison of union, says St. Teresa, the soul is fully awake as regards to God, but wholly asleep as regards to things of the world and in respect of herself. During the short time the union lasts, she is, as it were, deprived of every feeling, and even if she would, she could not think of any single thing. Thus she needs to employ no artifice in order to assist the use of her understanding. In short, she is utterly dead to the things of the world and lives solely in God. Thus does God, when he raises the soul to the union with himself, suspend the natural action of all faculties. But this time is always short, and it seems even shorter than it is. God establishes himself in the interior of the soul in such a way that when she returns to herself, it is wholly impossible for her to doubt that she has been in God and God in her. This truth remains so strongly impressed on her that even though many years should pass without the condition returning, she can neither forget the favor she received nor doubt of its reality. If you ask how is it possible that the soul can see and understand that she has been in God since during the union, she has neither sight nor understanding. I reply that she does not see it then, but that she sees it clearly later, after she has returned to herself, not by any vision, but by a certitude which abides with her and which God returned to herself. Not by any vision, but by a certitude which abides with her and which God alone can give her. Reverting to the same experience on another occasion, St. Teresa recounts how one day it was granted to her to perceive in one instant how all things are seen and contained in God. Quote, I did not, she adds, perceive them in their proper form, and nevertheless the view I had of them was a sovereign clearness and has remained vividly impressed upon my soul. This view was so subtle and delicate that the understanding cannot grasp it. Jacob Bohm is another classic example of this experience. His first illumination occurred in the year 1600 when he was 25 years of age, and he had a further and more vivid experience 10 years later. Martinson describes Bohm's first experience as follows. Sitting one day in his room, his eyes fell upon a burnished pewter dish which reflected the sunshine, which with such marvelous splendor that he fell into an inward ecstasy, and it seemed to him as if he could now look into the principles and deepest foundation of things. He believed that it was only a fancy, and in order to banish it from his mind, he went out upon the green. But here he had remarked that he gazed into the very heart of things, the very herbs and grass, and that the actual nature harmonized with that which he had inwardly seen. He said nothing to anyone but praised and thanked God in silence. He continued in the honest practice of his craft, and was attentive to his domestic affairs, and was on terms of goodwill with all men. Of his complete illumination, 10 years later, he says himself, quote, "The gate was open to me, that in one quarter of an hour I saw and knew more than if I had been many years together at university, at which I exceedingly admired, and thereupon turned my praise to God for it. For I saw and knew the being of all things, the bis and the abyss, and the eternal generation of the Holy Trinity, the decent, and the original of the world, and all of the creatures through the divine wisdom. I knew and saw in myself all three worlds, namely, the divine, angelical, and two, the dark, the original of the nature to the fire, and then three, the external and the visible world, being procreation or external birth from both the internal and the spiritual worlds. And I saw and knew the whole working essence in the evil and the good, and the original and the existence of each of them, and likewise how the fruit-bearing womb of eternity brought forth, so that I not only did greatly wonder at it, but did also exceedingly rejoice. Of men belonging to our modern world who have had the experience of cosmic consciousness, two only seem to my mind absolutely valid instances. One is Edward Carpenter, the author of Towards Democracy, a work of great breadth and insight, with which every reader of this magazine should make himself familiar, if he has not already done so. And James Alien, the author of From Poverty to Power, As a Man Thinketh, and many other booklets which may be characterized as essays on the spiritual life. Edward Carpenter has himself stated that he had this experience, and in fact intimated as much in a letter to Dr. Buck himself. "I really do not feel," he says in the letter, "that I can tell you anything without falsifying and obscuring the matter. I have done my best to write it out in Towards Democracy. I had no experience of physical light in this relation. The perception seems to be one in which all the senses unite into one sense, in which you become the object. But this is unintelligible, mentally speaking. I do not think the matter can be defined as yet, but I do not know that there is any harm in writing about it. Elsewhere in Civilization, its cause and cure," he writes more definitely on the subject. Quote, "There is in every man a local consciousness connected with his quite external body. That we know. Is there not also in every man the making of a universal consciousness, that there are in us phases of consciousness which are transcending the limits of the body's senses, which is a matter of daily experience, that we perceive and know things which are not conveyed to us by the bodily eyes and heard by our bodily ears is certain, that there arise in us waves of consciousness from those around us, from the people, the race to which we belong, is also certain. May there not be in us the makings of a perception and knowledge which shall not be relative to this body which is here and now, but which shall be good for all time and everywhere? Does there not exist in truth, as we have already hinted, an inner illumination, of which what we call light in the outer world is the partial expression and manifestation by which we can ultimately see things as they are, beholding all creation, not by any local act of perception, but by cosmical intuition and prescience, identifying ourselves with what we see? Does there not exist a perfected sense of hearing, as of the morning stars singing together, an understanding of the words that are spoken all through the universe, the hidden meaning of all things, a profound and far-pervading sense, of which our ordinary sense of sound is only the first novitiate and intuition?" Mr. Carpenter refers elsewhere to, quote, "that inner vision which transcends sight as far as sight transcends touch," and to a, quote, "consciousness in which the contrast between the ego and the external world and the distinction between subject and object fall away." These are surely the words of one who has himself undergone this experience. Carpenter, however, is careful to warn us that we are not to suppose that people who have this experience are in any way to be regarded as infallible as to its exact meaning. Quote, "In many cases, indeed," he remarks, "the very novelty and strangeness of the experience may give rise to the phantasmal trains of delusive speculation," end quote. In further interpretation of this mystery, he observes that the whole body is only, as it were, one organ of the cosmic consciousness. Quote, "To attain this latter, one must have the power of knowing oneself separate from the body, of passing into a state of ecstasy. In fact, Without this, cosmic consciousness cannot be experienced, end quote. It is perhaps well that Mr. Edward Carpenter has written of the matter so definitely and from such an aloof and impersonal standpoint as he has done, as those who have experienced the state have, as a rule, been both too reserved with regard to their spiritual experiences and too deficient in the critical faculty to give us anything that would appear to the ordinary mind as a satisfactory explanation of the phenomenon. We have nothing, for instance, in writing from Mr. James Alien, who claims to have had the experience more than once, which would throw any intimate light on what he saw and felt in connection with it, though it leaves its trace, as it must ever do, on his own standpoint in life, and on all that he has written. Mr. Alien claims to have had this experience in the first instance at 24, an unusually early age, while later on it returned after the interval of 10 years, as he says, a more permanent form. In 3 modern poets, Wadsworth, Tennyson, and Walt Whitman's, there are suggestions which point to some experience of the kind, and Walt Whitman, especially in his Leaves of Grass, has expressed in a singularly beautiful phraseology the mental attitude which we associate with the transmutation of the individual life by this mystical experience. The lines written by Wordsworth on Tintern Abbey in his 29th year are again singularly apposite in as an expression of the mental state to which cosmic consciousness serves as the portal. In these he speaks of, quote, that blessed mood in which the burden of the mystery, in which the heavy and the weary weight of all this unintelligible world is lighted, that serene and blessed mood in which the affections gently lead us on, until the breath of this corporeal frame and even the motion of our human blood almost suspended, we are laid asleep in body and become a living soul, while with an eye made quiet by the power of harmony and the deep power of joy, we see into the life of things, end quote. Further lines in the same poem suggest the occurrence of an actual personal experience in this connection, and we should perhaps be right if we class this poet, albeit with some hesitancy, along with the others given in these notes, as one of those who actually entered into this state of higher consciousness, who have been put en rapport with the unity of all created life, and have seen, quote-unquote, with a bodily eye, and not in any mere poetical vision, the light that never was on land or sea. Thus, he writes once more, I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thought, a sense of sublime, of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of the setting suns and the round ocean of the living air and the blue sky, and in the mind of man, a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of thought, and rolls through all things. End quote. Tennyson's verse, again, is steeped in mysticism, the depth of which the ordinary reader, and indeed the critic as well, have been too slow to appreciate. The author of Cosmic Consciousness himself speaks of this poet far too deprecatingly, and must, I am afraid, be numbered with those who fail to gauge his true greatness and the inwardness of what he wrote. The whole conception underlying the verses on the Holy Grail is steeped in a mystical insight, and the thought of the deep reality underlying the entire phantasmagoria of this phenomenal world is seldom far absent from the poet's thought. The following lines from the Holy Grail may be given as an instance, but they are only one example out of many. Let the visions of the night, or of the day, come as they will, and many of the time they come, until this earth he walks on seems not earth, this light that strikes his eyeball is not light, this air that smites his forehead is not air, but vision, yea, his very hand and foot, in moments when he feels he cannot die, and knows himself no vision to himself, nor the high God of vision, nor that one who rose again, yea, have seen what yea have seen. Again, in the ancient sage, as many readers will recall, he relates how, quote, revolving in myself, the word that is the symbol of myself, the mortal limit of the self was loosed and passed into the nameless as a cloud. Melts into heaven, I touched my limbs. The limbs were strange, not mine, and yet no shade of doubt, but utter clearness, and through loss of self, the gain of such large life as matched with ours, were sun to spark, unshadowable in words, themselves but shadows of a shadow world. This is admittedly the record of a personal experience, and is referred to as such in the poet's Life by His Son, the present Lord Tennyson. Dr. Buck gives many instances in his work of men who, in his view, have experienced cosmic consciousness in some form or other, but, by the critical mind, many of these can hardly be regarded as legitimate. Among these may be mentioned Muhammad, whose illumination might be defended by some, but who to my thinking rather appears to have written the Quran in much the same way as Madame Blavatsky wrote Isis Unveiled, and whom I should class rather as a natural medium in this respect than as a real illuminate. Dante is again another instance given, with regard to whom, however, conclusive evidence is lacking. The Bacon and Shakespeare controversy is introduced rather unfortunately into the present work, from which it would be well, I cannot help thinking, that such fantastic and irrelevant controversies were omitted. Several of the instances given in the present notes do not appear at all. No woman is named among the subjects of this experience. I myself have instanced St. Teresa, and among the moderns in this connection, Anna Kingsford, an illuminate of the very different type, should not be overlooked. Probably, at the present time, though Dr. Buck cites only the case of Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, this experience is more common among the saints and ascetics of India than in any other part of the world. A training which lends itself naturally to the production of such phenomena is the well-known yoga discipline, the goal of which is the attainment of samadhi, a state of near akin to, if not practically identical with, that known in the West as cosmic consciousness. Dr. Buck claims that the cases of cosmic consciousness are steadily increasing as the world grows older, and this may well be so, but the instances chosen by him are not unfrequently so capricious, while other important ones are omitted. That the list he gives in support of his contention will hardly carry conviction, more especially as only one is given from India. In Dr. Buck's opinion, there is a steady development of sentient life from that simple consciousness, which is possessed by the higher types of the animal kingdom, onward to the self-consciousness, which, together with the use of language, is the differentiating characteristic of mankind, right up to that of cosmic consciousness, which he holds will be, in eons to come, the heritage of all alike. By that time, it may be supposed mankind will have developed a more spiritual type of body and nervous organization, which will permanently responsive to influences which day to day reach only the rarest types of humanity in occasional and evanescent flashes. There you have it. That is the end of that piece. I know, again, it was a longer piece. However, I felt it was very interesting in terms of the godlike consciousness that people tend to report on and tend to feel. If you watch any kind of New Age shows, they talk about this as not only just cosmic consciousness, so they talk about it as the Akashic or the Akashic record. It's been popularized on shows like Ancient Aliens or in books like The Secret. All these kind of interesting elements and things. One thing that is for sure, and how this really relates to Masonry, aside from a Mason actually writing this, and Masonry being an occult science in itself, is the fact and the relationship of direct consciousness. In Masonry, being raised to the sublime degree of a Master Mason does not speak of anything other than being raised to a new level of consciousness. That is in print and definitively written, at least in my grand jurisdiction, in our lesson books for degree work. So just something to think about. There may be brothers out there and sisters out there who listen to this paper and they think, man, I gotta listen to that again. Well, you know, I have to read it two or three times before I read it for the show because I want to make sure I understand it before I read it. And there are elements of certain papers that I still don't understand, and that may be the case until I really dive in and try to break chunks away. And that happens with anything we read. This is one of our natural skills that we need to hone and develop is comprehension. These are deeper subjects and they are difficult, but this is part of doing the work of being a Mason, is studying our liberal arts and sciences, and then once we get there, being able to articulate and to comprehend complex ideas presented by our brethren. So that's it for this week. I hope you guys all had a fantastic previous week and a fantastic week to come. This episode is coming out on the 10th of December 2017. There will be an episode on the 17th, 2017. We will be dark for the episode of the 24th and the 31st. So there will be one more show before the end of the year, which will be December 17th, 2017. We will not have an episode out on the 24th. We will not have an episode out on the 31st. However, what are you going to do? Please check out Masonic Curators, which will still have episodes released on the 12th, 14th, 15th, 19th, 21st, 22, 26, 28, 29, the 2nd, the 4th, and the 5th. So we'll have all those will be taken up. There will also be Midnight Freemason articles happening Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays every single day. Not going to miss a beat. We don't take a day off. And, of course, the Masonic Roundtable, going live every Tuesday at 10, 9 Central. When I say every Tuesday, I mean every Tuesday. That's right. The day after Christmas, we'll be on. The day after New Year's, we'll be on. So check them out. It's going to be great. And as I've been telling you this month, keep on being awesome to each other. Let's continue the trend all year long. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.